Christian Peterson, and this is New Books in Religion. Welcome and thanks for joining us. I just finished talking with Vincent Gausser and David Palmer about their wonderful new book, The Religious Question in Modern China, which was published by University of Chicago Press in 2011. Social phenomena that some people like to call religion has long shaped Chinese culture. In the 20th century, defining the boundaries of what constitutes religion has been central to the construction of a modern nation. In this far-reaching book, authors Vincent Gausser and David Palmer help us tread the complex field of phenomena where religion is the central question. The question is answered again and again by intellectuals, politicians, and practitioners, each seeking their own objective in classifying particular social activities as religious or not. The authors lead us through the debates revolving around what various practices entailed and if they merit the classification religion, such as athletic practices, lay Buddhist activity, traditional medicine, Confucian movements, self-cultivation, evangelical Christianity, dietary practices, and Falun Gong, among many, many others. Of course, the answer depends on who you asked and when. In this rich book, though, we are offered a detailed analysis of Chinese questions about religion, secularity, and modernity in a global world. We had a long and interesting conversation, so without further ado, here's the interview. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion. Welcome to another episode of New Books in Religion. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Vincent Gausser and David Palmer about a great new book, The Religious Question in Modern China, which was published with University of Chicago Press in 2011. Before we get into the content of this book, I was hoping you could kind of give us a little bit of background on your training, how you got interested in studying Chinese religions, and then perhaps you could lead us through kind of how this book project developed.
I guess my interest in Chinese religion began when I was an undergraduate at McGill University in the late 1980s and early 1990s. I was majoring in anthropology and East Asian studies, and I did my honors thesis on the Jesuits in China, and I had as my advisor Ken Dean, who is a eminent specialist of popular religion and Taoism in Southeast China, and I guess he kind of planted the seed an academic interest in Taoism and Chinese religion. Although I must say that even earlier than that, when I was in high school, my good friend Elijah Siegler and I, are currently co-authoring a book. We used to take part in debating tournaments where we would cast the I Ching to find arguments for our debates. So I guess the interest in China and the Chinese religion actually goes pretty far. It's hard to explain why. And after I finished my studies in my undergraduate studies, I kind of took a turn towards psychology. I wanted to understand more about what goes on in people's minds. In preparation for doing a graduate study in ethnopsychiatry, I went to China, and it was there that I first came across the Qigong movement, which ultimately became the subject of my PhD thesis. I went back to Paris, and I studied under Christopher Skipper, who specializes in the anthropology and history of Taoism and Chinese religion in general. And that's where I met Vincent Gausser. He was also a student of Skipper's. He completed his PhD a few years before me. For me, what was interesting was that at the time that I was doing my PhD thesis, so this was in the late 1990s, at that time, and so I was working on Qigong, ultimately Falun Gong. The whole story was unfolding while I was doing my work. This was obviously a movement that had strong religious overtones, that was clearly a religious phenomenon in some way or another. But what was interesting was that really in the field of the study of Chinese religion, this kind of phenomena really appeared like a UFO, you could say, because generally speaking, it was still widely considered that religion had disappeared in China, or the only research on religion that you would do now was simply salvage ethnography, what remained in Taiwan and Hong Kong, even what might have been, what was starting to revive in rural China. But all of that was really not seen as anything that was relevant in any way whatsoever to the current and future unfolding of China's destiny. And so it just appeared as bizarre and surprising for everyone, including all the specialists on China, that this Falun Gong erupted and became such a big issue, threatened the legitimacy of the Chinese state. And suddenly, you know, everybody was like, huh, what's going on? What, how come this religion is coming? What is this anyway? Where is this coming from? How could this appear? And I think it really created a great, a kind of a commotion in the field of Chinese studies in general, and also in the field of the study of Chinese religion, which was really not seen as something that was relevant to contemporary society. It was all for historians and sinologists who worked on many dynasties earlier. This was, in a sense, for me anyway, and Vincent can tell you how he came up with the idea for this book, but it seemed then that we were really, for everyone, and there was this question about religion in China. Where does religion fit in the Chinese socio-political configuration? Why had it seemingly disappeared and suddenly reappeared? And when we came to those questions, it was clear that there was a whole history of, in a sense, erasing parts of China's heritage, reconceptualizing things in certain ways, which blinded almost everybody, whether they were scholars or Chinese intellectuals, or even most people in China, which blinded everybody to the deep religious structures of traditional Chinese society and the pervasiveness of religious dimensions to the modern evolution of Chinese society and to the continued vitality of religiosity in contemporary Chinese society. And so it really became clear that it was important to really sort all of these questions out. And in order to understand what is going on in the religious field in China today, we would really have to go back to the emergence of modernity in China and see how this drama had unfolded over more than a century.
Yeah, well, I came to the study of Chinese religion by chance or accident or a combination of both. I was actually studying business administration and doing an MBA, and I started to learn Chinese at the time, and I got into reading stuff, including on Taoism, and I basically fell in love with Taoism. And then I met Christopher Schipper, who was teaching the history of Taoism at École Pratique des Hautes Études in Paris. And that was in the 90s, early 90s. And I went to do a PhD with him, and that's how I fell into this field. I'm an historian, so I'm mostly working with texts, but trying to combine reading of text with field observation. That's not something particularly original. I mean, many of us in the field of Chinese religion do that. But it's certainly a certain approach doing history that might be somewhat different from some other colleagues. So we have this constant coming back and forth between libraries and the field in China. We were studying together with Christopher Schipper So we became good friends, but it took several years before we realized that we could do things together that neither of us could do on his own. The context for that was the late 90s and the early 2000s, when there was a major surge of interest for the contemporary situation of religion in China and in the Chinese world after the 99 Falun Gong events, and also because of the sustained interest in the West for what was going on in Chinese Christianity, and especially, of course, the underground Catholic Church and the Protestant house churches. The Tibetan question, of course, the Uyghur question as well. So there was a sustained interest and demand for information from the media, from the general public, and from colleagues from outside Chinese studies, and sometimes even within Chinese studies. And we found it difficult to answer this demand for information and analysis and contextualization, because we didn't have a clear overview of the religious situation in China at the time. There were increasing numbers of young scholars looking at the situation, either from a political or a law studies perspective, or sociologists or anthropologists looking at what was going on in the field. But most of those studies were focused on one particular religion or one particular area, one particular kind of issues, and there was no overview. And in order to both answer, I mean, meet the demand, I mean, the request of people in the media and also in diplomacy and other fields, and to help ourselves better understand what was going on, I came up with this idea to write a kind of short book summarizing what we knew about the situation of religion in China and trying to explain it from an historical perspective. And I very quickly came to the conclusion that that was not something that one single person could write, and we should join forces. But to write a book, fully write, co-author a book is something that is not common in our field. It might be common in other disciplines, but for historians or anthropologists, actually quite rare. And you need to be really good friends, because you need to be able to criticize each other. And scholars don't take criticism of their prose very easily. Some do, but many don't, right? You need to really build trust and to be able to tell things to each other. But it worked wonderfully well with David, because he's both a great scholar and a great person. And we utterly rewrote and changed things that the other had written, and that was okay, because we trusted each other, and we were sure that the results would be more than just the addition of the two, and that's what we were hoping for, and that's what I hope we have achieved. And anyway, it was a really great experience. It's very different from writing your own book, right? It's finding things that you had no idea you could write or conceptualize.
Yeah, you both have done a great job. So yeah, thank you for your contribution.
One of the best compliments we had is that people telling us, we had no way of finding out which chapters were David's and which chapter were Vincent's.
It's true. Now, you very consciously in the book don't employ religion as a thing that exists in itself. You talk mm-hmm. about it as a contested category, and that's actually what much of the book is doing, is demonstrating this, right. this dialogue. So, but could you explain what you mean by the religious question, since this does have an actual historical background to it, but also kind of a theoretical purpose for you?
Mm-hmm. So I guess right at the book, in a sense, started as this question for us and as a question for scholars and so on. But in a sense, we could talk about this question or how it operates in China at many levels. So when we talk about the the onset of Western modernity in China. So the first religious question appeared, which was really the religious question as it is understood. It's the European Enlightenment question of religion, which is how can we create a progressive society which is not burdened by the superstitious and anti-scientific dimensions of religion. So for the European Enlightenment, that was the question of religion. And so that kind of question was imported into China in the late 19th century and early 20th century. So in a sense, that was the first question. A question that, in a sense, in Europe, apparently had been solved. But in China, that by importing this kind of question, which involved a whole set of categories, it brought up a second question, which was the question of how do these Western categories, interconnected categories such as religion, science, and superstition. So what happens when you import these categories into China and you find that the way that culture is configured in China simply does not fit those categorizations. And so that generates a whole new set of questions, a whole new set of reconfigurations in the Chinese field, which confuse mix up the original science, superstition, religion configuration. And as we move into the middle of the 20th century, then on top of that question, a third religious question appeared, which was with the establishment of the People's Republic of China, was the question of the relationship between religion and a socialist regime, the question for the Chinese state authorities and the Communist Party of the loyalty or disloyalty of religion to its regime. So that is the third religious question, in a sense, and one which in mainland China for the government is perhaps the key one, but it's really tied in with all the other religious questions. And then, though, as we move beyond the revolutionary period and into the late 20th century, the fourth religious question becomes, and this is now we're really moving into what's going on in the whole world, the running out of steam of secularism, the revivals of religion around the world, but revivals which do not follow the traditional institutional configurations and traditional forms of religious authority. So religious revivals which are at the same time highly fragmented and often characterized by hyper-modern forms of networks and movements and so on. And so this is a new question, a religious question in the whole world, in a sense, is how is religion organized and configured, and what are its connections with other components of society and culture in the modern or postmodern era, so to speak. And finally, the fifth question is the one into which we are now entering with China's growing influence in the world, is that so we have all of these questions which overlay each other, which in a sense add on to each other, and now China as eventually becoming one of the most influential countries in the world, well, its religious configuration and religious questions become questions for the whole world. China exports religion to the world. Religious issues and controversies and conflicts which touch on China, they just by the nature of transnationalism and globalization, they impact on the whole world. And so in a sense, China also brings to the whole world other configurations of the connection between the religious and the secular, which will influence the religious configuration of the whole world. So in a sense, these are a whole set of questions, one of which has led to the others, and which have constantly made the whole socio-religious configuration ever more complicated.
So kind of from a theoretical angle, you guys are very clear about not trying to define religion for yourselves, but what you lay out is what you call an ecological approach. And you talk about the social ecology of the Chinese religious landscape. Can you kind of explain what you tried to do with this method and how this fits into kind of a modern Chinese society?
Yeah, the ecological approach is not like a strong theoretical framework that existed before we started writing this book. It's something that sort of came naturally out of the process of our writing first the part that we knew about, and then finding out all the black holes and the dark corners of the field, and aspect that nobody had ever written about, and that it still had to fill in somehow. And we found that all these many elements that we need to put together like a jigsaw puzzle in order to get this overview of the situation made us realize that that's really, the way religious ideas and religious practices work in modern Chinese society is a very complex system with many different elements interacting with each other. And when we started to write about this, ecological vocabulary sort of came naturally, dynamic equilibrium and niche and that kind of vocabulary came out quite spontaneously. And when looking at the first draft and revising and writing introduction, we found out that maybe that was the best way to account for what is basically an inherent pluralism, religious or ethical or moral or convictional pluralism that's proper to Chinese society, that has been proper to Chinese society for a long, long time, and that further increased during the modern period with the coming in of Western traditions and Western ideas in the Chinese world that did not displace or replace pre-existing religious or ethical, philosophical value system, but that further added to the complexity. So I think this idea that these systems where many different elements coexist because they fill different functions within Chinese society, right? You have Confucianism and Buddhism and Taoism and local cults and spirit position cults, and then Christianity, and then Islam, and then atheism. And then maybe civic religion and all those elements, they coexist, and we have to and they interact with each other, and we have to account for this pluralism, for this the coexistence of these different elements, because one of, I think, the ideas that are driving this book is that you need to see the whole thing in order to fully understand the specific elements within the field. So we made great use when writing the book of all the scholarship that has been written on Christianity, on Islam, on Buddhism, and so on and so forth. But I think we added something to this body of scholarship by putting all of this together within a framework. And that's true whether you look at the larger picture, China, or even if you look at smaller picture, like one place, one local society. Well, I'm also working on Chinese religion in France at the moment. And it's basically the same thing. We use the same framework, because even in a smaller, it's not that small, but the smaller and the recent migrant Chinese community, like the Chinese community in Paris, there is an absolutely dazzling, fascinating pluralism of religious, moral, ethical value system at work. And they are competing to a certain extent, but they are also coexisting. You see people being engaged in Buddhist groups and Taoist groups and sometimes in Christian groups and sometimes in new religions. And there is a coexistence there and a plurality and pluralism that I think other theories, such as the rational choice theory, don't fully account for. And I think the ecological framework that looks at the coexistence of these different elements within one complex system is better, at least has better potential to explain both this pluralism, this coexistence, and the evolution of a system that is never stable but always evolves when one element grows bigger or tends to have negative effects on the other related elements around it. So so maybe using this religious ecology vocabulary in that book was a preliminary attempt to find a Chinese-informed model to talk about religious plurality that hopefully will be useful for studying other cultures and other areas in the future when it grows into a more mature theory.
Now, one of the major things you do in this book, which I think everyone studying religion will benefit from, is you really demonstrate how kind of the deployment of these categories and their consequences plays out. So could you give us maybe kind of a bird's eye view of what the Chinese religious landscape looks like, and then how some of those categories are being implemented, such as religion or superstition or science or others?
So I guess it's helpful to look at this historically. If we look at the traditional Chinese socio-political configuration and cosmology, so we see an integrated system which is not characterized by a dualistic dichotomy between the spiritual and the material, the religious and the secular, in which all social institutions, to some degree or another, were religious institutions. So the family, the traditional family in China, is a religious institution. The core of family life was ancestor worship. And so the core of a traditional Chinese home is a shrine to ancestors. The cult to the ancestors is really the institutional structure of the traditional Chinese family. So in that sense, the family is a religious institution. And this goes all the way up to the emperor, the empire itself. The emperor is the high priest worshiping heaven. And the mandarins, the magistrates, not only administer and dispense justice, but they're also ritual specialists. The Confucian examination system is one that involves also learning all about the practice of how does one engage in the proper practice of ritual in order to maintain social order. And so no matter and we could go on and on, all social organizations in traditional China were religious organizations. And so what we see is a religious landscape where the religious and the secular in all social in all social institutions is rather deeply enmeshed, and in fact you can't really separate the religious and the secular at all. In the late 19th century and early 20th century, but of course starting earlier than that, when missionaries come in, then we start to have a whole intellectual and practical and eventually policy and political work starts to be set in motion, in which there is an attempt to map the Chinese reality onto categories imported from the West. And so the basically Christianity appears as the paradigm of a new category of religion, of zongjiao. So now an institution which is has a strong self-identity, which is distinct from other social institutions. So this is Christianity, of course. This is not the essence of Christianity, but it's basically Christianity as it, the configuration of Christianity it's the 19th century configuration of Christianity. So a church which has been functionally differentiated from other social institutions, and so in which religious life is clearly distinguished from secular life, and which has its own institutions, with its scriptures, its clergy, and its relatively centralized organization. So when we then try to map that onto China, then what happens is that, well, there aren't that many Chinese organizations that really fit that understanding, that paradigm of religion. There are some that do to a certain degree. So basically monastic Buddhism seemed to fit pretty well. And well, that was about it. Everything else that as I described involved worshiping of ancestors, of deities, of heaven, but in a fashion that's completely integrated with other social institutions, well, that just didn't count. And that was just really it didn't count. It was not the noble religion equivalent to Christianity, and so that is just superstition. And so this kind of mapping led most people, including most Chinese intellectuals, right from the early 20th century, to consider that there was no religion in China, or hardly any religion in China. And this is a perception that has continued which continues pretty much until today. So even though that you could, according to all the historical evidence, if you walk down a street in a Chinese city in the early 20th century, the number of temples and shrines, the smoking incense all over the place, surely was no less than what you would expect to find in India. And according to Ken Dean's work in some parts of Fujian, it is still very much like that. And yet these people who had shrines and incense and earth gods under their feet, ancestral shrines in their own homes, temples at every city block, these intellectuals, they started writing that there is no religion in China. And that is simply because there was no religion that looked like Christianity. And so what they had, what they were seeing all around them was adopting a view coming from both Christianity and from secularism, so both contradictory currents coming in from the West. It led them to label all of that as a superstition. So this had no legitimacy, and eventually under all forms of basically throughout the 20th century, different under all political regimes, the common practices of the people in all the different social institutions was delegitimized, banned, actively suppressed, campaigned against, and destroyed for about a century. And so to look at the contemporary landscape, so what do we see then? Well, we see that in spite of all of the campaigns of anti-superstition, which have tried to destroy temples and everything, and nonetheless, particularly in rural China, we, we see an astounding revival of a lot of the communal village, traditional, what we call popular religion. And so this is certainly not dead by far. And after many decades of active suppression of this type of religion, now, owing to, for a number of reasons, including nationalist reasons and just pragmatic reasons, the level of hostility, of intellectual and official hostility to this type of religiosity has actually declined significantly. So the space for this is still open, but actually it is still not legal in mainland China. And so around that, which is really the core of traditional Chinese religion, we have the, in mainland China, we have the five officially recognized religions. So those religions that kind of fit the paradigm. And so you have Roman Catholicism, Protestantism, Buddhism, Islam, and Taoism. Taoism almost didn't make that designation, but ultimately it did in its monastic form, which is really a minority, although perhaps more orthodox, form of Taoism. So these five religions in China have their state-sponsored official religious associations, which try to manage and to control what goes on under the name of that religion in China. But actually outside of that, you have various degrees of unofficial and underground or unregistered Christians, Catholics, Protestants, Buddhists, Taoists, whatever you want. So we have a certain level of state-sponsored and state-controlled religion in China, and a much larger realm of semi-recognized, semi-legal, what Feng Gangyang calls the gray market of religion in China, which is very which is vast, which is the greatest portion of religion in China. And in addition to, so these, what I just described as the, maybe what we now still find in rural China, especially, so the more traditional popular religion, these five institutional religions, then we have in the cities all kinds of modern forms of religiosity or modern combinations or reinventions of different types of religious and spiritual practices. So whether it was the Qigong, for example, there was a Qigong boom in the 1980s and 90s. That has abated. However, there are all kinds of other forms, whether various types of Buddhist study groups and Confucius scripture recitation movements, popularity of Tibetan Buddhism, growing Christianity, feng shui, all kinds of different practices are growing very fast in a highly individualistic, atomized urban configuration in China's cities. And they really don't fit under any, many of these don't fit under any category.
You begin your kind of quest to figure out how social activity and social phenomena is classified within the Chinese situation in 1898. Can you tell us a little bit about 1898 and what's going on and why this is the start for your investigation?
Okay, I think I'm fully responsible for this 1898 more than David, even though I think I successfully sold the idea to David. I came to the whole question of religious change in 20th century China. I mean, from the perspective of a historian who's mostly been working on 16th to 19th century history, and that's what I'm still doing. Actually, this book is kind of a foray into really contemporary history for me, a little bit away from my basis at times. And from my research experience on late imperial China, it's up to the late 19th or very early 20th century, we have this clear vision of a country that is covered with temples. So one estimate, and it's probably a very conservative estimate, is that at the turn of the 20th century, we had basically one temple. And when I say one temple, it's a very encompassing category, including Buddhist, Taoist, Confucian, and mostly temples, shrines to local gods and local saints. Right? It's a temple in the largest sense. We had maybe one temple for 100 families or for 400 people. So there were 400 million Chinese at the turn of 20th century. So we had 1 million temples. And so we read sources from that period. We have temples absolutely everywhere. In the tiniest, poorest, remote village, we have several temples. And when you go to China now, it depends very much on where you go, of course. But in many places, you don't see temples anymore. So the question was, what happened to those temples? The situation, I mean, the scholarly situation has changed a lot since I began to inquire into that question like 10 or 15 years ago, because at the time, historians of modern China mostly considered that this was not a problem. I mean, China had to modernize, it had to westernize, and so it had to do away with traditional values and traditional society in order to make way for a modern country, you know, with its educational institutions and state building institutions like, you know, police posts and so on and so forth. So for most of those historians, the fact that the temple disappeared was just natural, right? They were turned into, you know, school or post office or army barracks and whatnot, and that was considered a natural process, not an historical question. But when you read historical sources from that period, you realize that transformation of temples into this schools and barracks and local administrations was not natural at all, and it was argued and fought and people revolted, and it was actually something that needed to be studied historically. Why some reformers choose to turn temples into schools, and why people resist it, and why in some cases that could be negotiated, right? Like sharing the temple into one part for worship and one part for, you know, schooling the local children, and why in other cases this no agreement could be met, and the situation was solved by outright conflict and one party winning over the other by mere force. I try to understand that process, and in order to understand what happens to this very religious society that I was studying for the 19th century and what happened to it during the 20th century. And so I wrote this article more than 10 years ago that argued that, of course, this was a process, but that a key turning point was 1898, when the first decree to transform all the temples in China into schools was enacted. So there's a whole story behind that. I'm not going to go into the story in any detail now, but what happened is that the reform movement that had pushed for this law, this basically nationalization of temples law, this movement was soon after swept aside, but the idea was not buried, and it resurfaced just a few years later as in 1901, and it gradually gained the assent of most of the local elites, so that it was actually implemented and got into full swing by the Republican regime. So my argument was that we don't have a imperial regime that's conservative and religious that is replaced overnight in 1911 by a republican regime that's lay and modern and secular and whatnot. And that the idea that China needed to turn its temples into schools was already implemented during the late years of the imperial regime. And so that's why I chose this 1898 movement as the first turning point of this history of modern Chinese secularism. But at the same time, I also wanted to suggest that it was not natural for those reformers trying to implement it. And when the edict to turn temples into school was proclaimed on July 10th, 1898, it was received in the newspapers at the time as a declaration of religious reform, not just as a convenient way to find resources, I mean money and space, to build the modern schools that modern China needed. And it was argued and resisted, and that still now the question of how local society should be organized and whether it needs temples or not and what's the place of worship and ritual in local society, it's still debated. And I mean, the question that was open then is not closed.
Yeah, a large part of the book, you focus on these things that people don't generally study when they study religion. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how these fit in. So you talk about things that are classified as culture, things like martial arts and Chinese medicine, and historically, if these things are not separated from what are at the time being classified as religion, for what purposes are they being classified, these other things, or how does this kind of play out in sifting out what is what during the 20th century?
Right. Yeah. I mean, people always ask, like, why are you talking about Chinese medicine here? Why are you talking about martial arts? Why are you talking about Confucianism? Why are you talking about all these things? That's not religion. But that question itself, that's exactly the kind of question which leads to the divisions that I was just talking about, between not only the religious and the superstitious, but the religious and the cultural, the religious and the scientific, the religious and the medical, and so on. If we look at something like, well, let's look at, for example, Chinese medicine and martial arts. These two sets of practices are actually based on a single common cosmology. And the ontology at the root of Chinese medicine and of martial arts is really one that can only be described, if you wish, as metaphysical. Involves connecting with Tao, the invisible forces of the universe, qi, yin and yang, the five elements. And so they involve connecting the body to and transforming the body according to an ontology which really is not at all, which cannot fit under mechanistic, materialistic, materialist worldview. And the martial arts, for example, involve a practice in which the body is aligned to a certain, to this ontology. And during the course of this alignment to this ontology, there's not only a transformation of the body, but there's also a transformation of the mind and a transformation in the direction of virtue as well. So within the practice of martial arts itself, we have a complete integration of the body, of the mind, of the spirit, of the physical, and of this of the metaphysical. It's all there, and it's completely inseparable. And so it doesn't fit nicely under religion, but it actually doesn't fit nicely under sports either. And that's why it has not yet been accepted as an Olympic sport. Chinese medicine, exactly the same thing. So Chinese medicine doesn't fit nicely under the category of religion, but its status as a medical practice is still highly contested under the criteria of Western biomedicine. Again, because it's a completely, it completely integrates what by Western ontologies are both physical and metaphysical dimensions of reality. And so what happens when these kinds of practices are then, when people come in with a conceptual framework coming from a dualistic Western intellectual background, so then now you have to define these things. And the definition of these things is not just an intellectual exercise. It really it is a policy issue. I mean, you have to regulate. Medicine is something that the state regulates in all countries of the world. You have to license doctors. You have to license medical training schools. So this is a practical policy question. So there are serious implications to how you define, how you categorize these practices. So what can you do, right? You have what is really an organically connected system of knowledge and practice. And so what we see is some advocates of these, well, first of all, what we see is modernizing reformers wanting to throw these into the dustbin of history. So let's get rid of our superstitious medicine. Let's get rid of our superstitious martial arts. All of this is the cause of our weakness. All of this is what has led us to be unable to resist and to defend ourselves against Western imperialism. So let's throw it out. That's one of the that's one of the attitudes to this thing. It's just superstition. But then we have advocates of these traditions coming up, and they say, no. This is valuable. It actually is good for the body. It's good for health. It's even better than what the West has to offer. So among the advocates, then you have, in a sense, you always have two possibilities. Then you can either position this system of practices as a non-religion or as a religion, but you have to put it in one or the other. So the pressure is to in order to save it, because it doesn't fit well under religion. So then you have the pressure to save these traditions, to categorize it as non-religion. And so a whole process is set in motion where you try to eliminate all of the non-materialist ontologies, cosmological foundations of these practices, or hide them. You either eliminate them or hide them, and you turn Chinese medicine, or you turn the martial arts into something that is simply herbal medicines that can be researched for the molecular properties of the herbs in order so that they can fit the basically become a branch of Western medicine, so to speak. Or you try to reconceptualize the cosmology of Chinese medicine to make it compatible with Marxist dialectical materialism, which, you know, yin yang can be said to be a primitive form of dialectical materialism. So you basically redefine the whole tradition in secular terms. So you could do that with Chinese medicine, you do it with martial arts, you do it with the Qigong. But then what ends up happening, though, is that it's impossible to completely remove that core, that ontological core, which is something else. It's not, it just doesn't fit in the materialist or mechanistic worldview. And so these things, they keep coming out again. They reappear at unsuspected moments. That ontological core reappears, and the boundaries between the religious and the secular become blurred again. So that's one of the options. And the other option is to do it the other way around, to turn it into religion. We in terms of Chinese medicine and martial arts, that option hasn't been the most commonly chosen option, but we can see this divide very clearly in the case of Confucianism. So again, Confucianism completely integrates the religious and the secular, but now there are debates that rage on and on about whether Confucianism is a religion or is it not a religion. And the debate is really because it's because of this conceptual, this issue of this religious question, the question of categories. So right from the early 20th century, so you had those who wanted to turn Confucianism into a purely secular philosophy, and then you had those who wanted to turn Confucianism into a state religion, really modeled along the lines of the Catholic of the Catholic Church. So having Confucian mass every Sunday and so on. So this divide is very clear in the case of Confucianism. And it has become so total that there are scholars of Confucianism who study Confucianism in philosophy departments of universities who have no idea that they're one of the largest religions in Taiwan, Yiguandao, is basically the largest promoter, the largest organized promoter of Confucianism, is a highly religious organization which worships deities, which practices vegetarianism, which believes in miracles and apocalyptic prophecies. All of this is going on a massive scale, and yet most scholars of Confucianism have no idea, because they've learned that Confucianism is just a secular philosophy.
From the late 70s to today, you talk about the reconstruction of temple life. Can you tell us about the factors that led to the resurgence in temple-based communal practices? How temple-based practices shape contemporary identities?
There are a number of factors that vary very much from one place to the next, and even the extent of the temple reconstruction movement is extremely different. I mean, you still have some counties, in especially in northern China, not only there, where the local cadres and local officials are still very conservative in their views and do not allow for the reconstruction of temples, and you still have a landscape, to follow on our ecological metaphor, a local landscape where formal, visible religious institutions have almost no place, or just a couple of Buddhist or Taoist or Christian or Muslim places of worship that are affiliated with the official associations, but that's really very little. But in those cases, you should not jump to the conclusion that there is no religion. There is a lot of religion going on, but it's usually underground, like house churches or other unofficial movements. And actually, some officials are coming now to recognize that maybe it's better to allow temples to reconstruct, because temples tend to be willing to work with government as long as they are given enough, you know, space to develop and do their own activities. They tend to be supportive of local government and to collect money for and to help the government. I mean, setting up charities and helping the poor and so on and so forth. And in some other parts of China, local governments are now very flexible and pretty easily give authorization or at least tolerate the building or rebuilding of local temples. So the situation is extremely varied. And of course, if you extend that to the Chinese world in general, I mean, if you include, and that's one of the things we try to achieve in that book, is to not just look at the People's Republic of China, which is, of course, the most important part of the Chinese world, but also taking into account Taiwan and Hong Kong, Macau and Singapore and Chinese communities in Southeast Asia and in Europe and North America and now in Africa as well. And to look at the circulation of people, of ideas, of practices, right? So when you look at the situation of temples in those different parts of the Chinese world, you realize that, and first, as I said, there is a huge and fascinating diversity, but also very strong resilience. You have places where temples have been destroyed as early, I mean, long before the communists ever appeared on the scene. You have places where temples were destroyed in the 1910s, right? But the resilience in the sense that people still remember where the temple was, how it looked like, what were the gods inside the temple like, what were the festivals, who played what role in the festivals. And you have festivals that have not been organized since the 1920s or 30s and that resuscitate now. And when you have historical sources and you compare, you realize that people do pretty much as they were doing, as their grandparents were doing two generations ago, because the local social memories has transmitted those religious practices. They still know how to, you know, perform in the temples, perform like ritual theater and opera, perform the sacrifices, what text to read, what text to chant or recite, and so on and so forth. So there is a very strong memory, because these things do mean an awful lot to local people, because they are about their place in the Chinese world, their place in the whole universe. They are about moral order. And the question of morality is central, because temples are also places that legitimate a local community and where leaders can find their own legitimacy. And that's the reason why many of the temples that are being reconstructed now are not, even when they are not officially recognized or authorized. And that's the case for most of the temples that we can visit in China today. They are not authorized, but they are tolerated. But they are not civil society against the state. That's a major mistake that some people would, when they are confronted with that phenomenon, that they might do when thinking of Western models. You know, people, you know, they disapprove of state crackdown on their religious practice, and they reconstruct their own temple, even though the government does not allow them to. But that's not the case at all. It's not civil society against the state, because the managers, the leaders of the local temples, they are very often local cadres, like retired party secretary. Because first, these people have the social networks and social know-how to organize, collect money, organize, get tacit authorization from higher authorities in order to get a temple going and festivals going. And second, those active or retired local officials or cadres manage temples because temples embody a sense of common good. Temples are there for the whole community's welfare, for praying the gods, for the welfare of the community, like good harvest, fair weather, avoiding disaster or pestilence, but also about maintaining cooperation between the different segments of local society, because it's encompassing. And they are about honesty, because you can embezzle public money when you're an official, but if you serve in a temple community and you embezzle temple money, then you run the risk of being punished by the gods, and the gods don't take that kind of behavior lightly, right? So there is a general social trust toward temples, and that's why some sociologists and political scientists have observed that people are much more willing to give money to temples, for temples to manage provision of public goods, than they are of paying tax money and entrusting a local government to provide the same kind of public goods. So these temples are still, as they have been for centuries, they are still about the welfare of the public community and redistribution of resources. Even though we certainly don't want to say that things have not changed and the temples are exactly the same and play the same function as they have been doing for centuries, because there have also been major changes. I mean, the kind of local elites that were controlling temples in the 19th century don't exist anymore, right? So the social makeup of temple communities have changed, and also their economic basis. Temples used to own an awful lot of land and property. In many parts of China, religious institutions controlled a very large proportion of the land. That's not the case anymore. I mean, land has been confiscated in the 20th century, and it has not been given back. Right. So temples have adapted. They have adapted the social makeup of their leadership and the community supporting them, and they have adapted to the new capitalist economy. But they still embody these old ideas of common welfare and public good.
Now, one of the kind of final issues you address in the book is this issue of ethnicity, political allegiance, and I guess turmoil, right? So we think of Tibetan Buddhism, we think of Islam. Could you talk a little bit about how this fits into the book and for what purposes you're talking about it?
Right. Actually, right. The issue of ethnicity is that's also a very interesting ingredient into this into the mix. So China being a multi-ethnic, having been a multi-ethnic empire, now a multi-ethnic People's Republic, includes ethnic groups with different religious identities. And going back to this issue of the religious question, for some of these ethnic minorities, particularly in Western China, or some of the largest borderland ethnic minorities, so the Uyghur in Xinjiang, the Tibetans, the Mongols, the Dai, they all basically, you have a correspondence between one ethnic group and one religion. So in a sense, there's no religious question there. It's an easily identifiable religion. It has a name. So the Uyghurs are Muslims. The Tibetans are Tibetan Buddhist. The Dai are Hinayana Buddhist. It's clear. One ethnic group has one religion. And that religion is easily identifiable. It's one of the world religions. So the issue of identity, the religious identity of ethnic groups, in a sense, is pretty straightforward according to a certain way of looking at things. But for the Han Chinese minority, again, going back to this issue of the religious question, that's not the way it works. There is not a single easily identifiable religious tradition to which the entire Han population identifies with, which is not to say that there's no religion there, but the religion is organically integrated to the entirety of social life. It is not a separately identifiable single religious tradition. So religious identity per se has not been an important part of the national identity of the Han Chinese. Now, the implications for this are that while the as the majority ethnic group trying to establish its control over minority ethnic groups living in the borderland, highly strategic borderland areas, which cover more than half of China's landmass, placating the religious identities and sensibilities of the ethnic minorities has been a very important part of China's ethnic policy for a very long time. Now, so what we've had is a bifurcation here where while the Han Chinese were, the Han Chinese intellectuals and politicians were actively involved in campaigns to destroy their own religious heritage, however, in dealing with ethnic minorities, they, in a sense, they almost engaged in the opposite policy in affirming that an integral part of the identity of these ethnic minorities was their religion. And so this is something that is worth debating for, I think, for scholars, to what extent this may have actually even reinforced the religious identity of some of the ethnic minorities in China. For the People's Republic of China, in many ways, the religious policy has largely been conflated with ethnic policy. How do we deal with the religious dimension of ethnic groups, ethnic identity? And so this has had both positive and negative impacts on certain ethnic groups in terms of how they can live their religious life. So I think a good case in point is the case of Islam, where the argument could be made that in the case of the Hui Muslim minority, so the Hui are an ethnic are now defined as an ethnic minority in China, but basically they are Muslims who are largely outside of their Islamic culture, are very similar to the Han Chinese. They speak like the Han. They look like the Han. They are also dispersed throughout China in different urban centers, and very well integrated into the larger Han society. And so for these people, the religion, the Islamic religion, has been the main marker of ethnic identity. And so for these people, practicing Islam has been politically understood as really practicing their ethnic customs. And so there has been much more leeway for the practice of Islam by the Hui and some other minorities than there has been for perhaps any other religion in China. So in a sense, that has been very positive for the Hui in their religious practice. But for the Uyghurs, for example, it might be the opposite situation, where their Islam and its transnational connections, the assumed connections between Islam and separatism have really led to harsh restrictions on the practice of Islam by the Uyghurs. So I think that the in terms of ethnic groups in China, we really have a bifurcation with the Han in that in the management and the identity construction of ethnic minorities, religion has always been a key part of that kind of construction. And that's been an element of the construction of ethnic minorities' identity, which has been actively, in a sense, the state itself has actively participated in that construction, but which is something that has definitely not been doing in terms of its own construction of the identity of the Han people.
Now, there's so much in this book that we really didn't even scratch the surface. But one of the real strengths and of both of your research is the depth in sources that you guys have examined. I'm wondering if, from that vantage point, you could give us a sense of what you think we should be doing in the study of Chinese religions. What directions can we go? What perhaps have we been doing too much? What have we not been doing enough?
I think we've been trying to fill in this sort of jigsaw puzzle, trying to give a comprehensive picture of this field, this very plural, diverse field of Chinese religion. We have found ourselves that there were questions that had not been covered by scholarship so far. So in some cases, we've done some research of our own in the sources, I mean, the published sources, archival sources, or doing fieldwork. But in many cases, we have just pointed at such a new direction. Just one example, the question of a death ritual. Of course, religion is to an important extent about managing death and mortality and what to do with the dead and what do people become when they die and is there a life after death. But there's been surprisingly little research. There was some research, but not that much on ideas of the afterlife and the care of the dead during the 20th century. So I think we've tried to give some pointers here, but there's much more to be done in that direction. And the related question is morality, the history of morality and moral values. And yet another related question is, because the question of care of the dead and filial piety is very strongly linked to morality, right? The idea of a good life and the question of the retribution of the acts, right? When you do good, you're rewarded. When you sin, you're punished for your sins. I think we don't have so far a very clear idea of the evolution and transformation of those values during the 20th century and how different religious and moral authorities, including, of course, Christian churches and the Muslim religious authorities and Buddhist and Taoist and Confucian leaderships, but also lay authorities, communists, ideologues as moral authorities, and the role of school education in the transformation of the value systems and moral universes of the Chinese people during the 20th century and up to the present. I think that's an important direction for new research. Yet another one. There would be many more such understudied areas that appeared in the process of our writing of overview, but I won't mention all of them, of course. Another one is the question of the new production of knowledge. Up to the 90s, the general idea was that religion was really pushed to the margin under the effect of the 20th century nationalist and then communist anti-religious and anti-superstition policies. But actually, it appeared that this was not the case. And at the same time, as certain parts of the religious landscape were battered or deeply transformed by those policies, a whole new series of religious movements sprung up, in some cases filling up the gaps opened by the destruction of the anti-religious, anti-superstition policies, and that it was an incredible, an extremely, very effervescent wave of religious creativity throughout the 20th century, and especially in two waves. The first one, and David wrote about that both in the book and in his subsequent writings. There's a first wave during the Republican period during the 1910s, 20s, and 30s, when a large numbers of new religious groups appeared and both recycled earlier ideas and ritual and practices and text and worldviews, but also introduced new elements. I mean, there was the production of religious texts during that period is just staggering. I mean, tens and tens of thousands of religious books, and new religious books, not just reprints of earlier ones, were produced and printed and widely disseminated during this period. And this is something that's just barely begun to attract the attention of scholars. These books are now beginning to be available through reprints or just because the libraries that hold them let scholars access those books. But now there is a large task for a new generation, or maybe several generations of scholars, just to look at this prediction of knowledge and see how these writers that wanted to talk about religion, the place of religion in a modern China, what they had to say during this wave of the first half of the 20th century, and what's the connection with the new wave that we are witnessing right now. The whole Chinese world, People's Republic, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Southeast Asia, Europe, North America, Africa, wherever. I mean, the Chinese world is encompassing the whole world nowadays. So throughout this Chinese world, there was a huge production of books, CDs, websites, and so on and so forth, with religious ideas circulating. And again, you need, even though it's getting more difficult by the day to keep track of all of this and to get to have a larger view, an overview of this fast expanding field, but still there is so much communication between different groups, different traditions, ideas, concepts, practices, vocabularies, images are circulating all the time. Throughout the world, crossing boundaries and geographical boundaries, political boundaries, confessional boundaries, and this fantastic religious creativity that we are witnessing now is both a product of our times, but also a continuation of the earlier phases of religious production. So there is a continuous production of books and ideas that is a whole field of study in itself. And I think there's a lot to be done there for many young scholars. And last but not least, this Chinese production of religious knowledge is also increasingly affecting non-Chinese people. And we see that in the West. It's very, I think, visible here in France, but it's just as much the case in North America or other parts of the world where Westerners learn Chinese, Chinese texts and ideas are being translated into other languages, images don't necessarily need translation, and practices are being taught and disseminated in all kinds of venues and all kinds of transcultural ways. And so this production, religious productivity of modern China is now impacting the whole world.
Well, I think that there's been a lot of very positive developments in the past decade or so. Of course, the root of the study of Chinese religion has been in Sinology. And I'm very happy about that. I think that the study of religion in China should be well-grounded in the study of Chinese history and civilization. And so that root is there, and I think it's important that that root not be abandoned. Now there is a move. The good thing is that the study of contemporary religion using other disciplinary approaches and other methodologies is booming, but that Sinological root is there, and I think it should definitely be maintained. The collaboration, I would say, the communications between historians, anthropologists, and sociologists have been very fruitful. I think the field, after all, it's not a huge field, and so I think most of the scholars who work with different disciplines and methodologies know each other personally. They meet each other a lot, and overall, there's a very collegial. There's a real, very collegial atmosphere between the scholars who are coming from very different disciplines, and I think our book reflects that. We've really we've consciously tried to overcome disciplinary boundaries, and so to use really to combine historical, anthropological, sociological, and even political science approaches. But in a sense, I don't think we're totally unique either. I think that this cross-disciplinary orientation is quite strong in the field of religion in China. And I hope that, of course, as the field continues to grow and different disciplinary approaches become more mature and the number of scholars increases, I hope that that cross-disciplinary intimacy doesn't dissipate. I hope that this kind of conversation between historians, sociologists, and anthropologists continues. In terms of what is missing, well, I think maybe there are two things. I think that now we have a lot of studies that are, in a sense, still focusing on more conventional understandings of the religious. So there are large numbers of PhDs now, I think, in progress that are either on various churches in China or popular religion, temple religion or so on. Yeah. And there's a lot of that that's going on. But really, what about urban religiosity? China is becoming a massively urban country. And the complete, it's a laboratory where anything goes. And I think that more studies of what is going on in terms of the hypermodern inventions and reinventions of religion in urban settings, I think still needs, still more work is needed. And again, this often really, it transcends the boundaries between the religious and the non-religious. So whether you're looking at self-help, success literature, themes in film, the growth of psychology, other forms of, the reconfigurations of Christian piety. I mean, there's just so much going on. And all of this is in flux. It's hard to define, and so it's not so easy to construct an object of research. But I think that there's a lot going on there that could still be researched. I think also is in the level of theory. I think the sociologists, and now speaking as an anthropologist, I think the sociologists have done a lot of great work in bridging the gaps between sociological theory, or particularly the theory of the sociology of religion. So Western-derived theory of sociology of religion and the Chinese situation, more subtle understanding of how Western-derived theories in the sociology of religion do apply in China, and very well sometimes, and don't apply in other cases. So I think there's a certain level of maturity there, which is gradually emerging, helping to theorize what's going on in religion in China, helping to put it into dialogue with what's going on in the rest of the world, and yet not falling into some simplistic universalisms. So I think that's been overall a good trend, although I think that the sociology of religion in general could really benefit from other theories outside of the sociology of religion. Sociology of religion seems to be trapped in debates between, you know, the secularization hypothesis on the one hand and the religious market theory on the other. And actually, there's so many other really interesting theories in sociology which could be fruitfully applied to religion in China. And so that's what's going on in sociology. In anthropology, unfortunately, I think there's been far less of that dialogue between China and outside of China. There's been so much ethnographic work on religion in China, but it really hasn't dialogued well with what's going on in anthropology outside of the China field. I mean, anthropologists tend to focus more on the local, but I think there's also potentially a lot of work that could be done. I hope to help contribute to that in the future.
Now, many of our listeners will be excited to hear what kind of things you've been working on in the years after the writing of this book, and what kind of things you might be having coming out for us in the future.
Well, I might disappoint some of the readers who are mostly concerned with the contemporary situation in China and outside China if I tell them that I have, to a large extent, retreated to my base, which is the late imperial history. I'm mostly working on 16th to late 19th century sources now, and continuing my work on what I was mentioning earlier, that the role of religion in making a local society, and especially in Jiangnan. But I'm still, of course, very interested in contemporary development. I do as much fieldwork as I can in this area, and observing both the long-standing place of religious rituals and practices in this local society and their contemporary situation. So that's one thing. I mean, trying to keep the bring the story down to the present, but trying also to push it back further in time and look at the longer, deeper roots, local society in Jiangnan, and the way religion organize peoples and communities and institutions and social practices. So that's one thing. I've also been interested in the production of moral norms through a genre called morality books, shanshu in Chinese. And I've been translating some of those books, mostly in French, but I've also some project to do translation in English as well, and trying to trace the history of moral ideas and moral norms through that kind of textual production, again, since the at least the 16th century and in some cases earlier on, and down to the present. And I also have this project I also mentioned on with some colleagues here on Chinese religion in France. France is the largest country for Chinese migration in Europe, so we have a large community, and there was new temples or places of worship or religious communities being established almost by the day. It's also an occasion to do fieldwork in China without having to fly to China, taking the subway or the bus or cycling around. I think that's a new perspective and a new take on what is Chinese religion, what is the importance of religion in Chinese societies and social organization and ideas of community in the specific context of migration.
So right now, yeah, there are just so many things I love. So I have too many things. I have this kind of lineup of different projects in progress, and I hope that at least one of them will soon see the light of will soon come to fruition. I'm currently finishing up a book with Elijah Siegler of the College of Charleston. It's called Dream Trippers, Global Taoism and the Predicament of Modern Spirituality. And this is a study of encounters between American Taoist practitioners and Chinese Trenzhen Taoist monks at Huashan. And so through an anthropological study of these encounters, it really tries to reflect on the implications of the globalization of Taoism as China's indigenous religion, globalization coming full term. So a westernized Taoism now coming back to China. So what are the implications of that? What effects does that have? So that's one thing. And this leads us to a more broader question on what we call the predicament of modern spirituality, the tension between traditional authority and the precariousness of a completely self-centered spiritual individualism. So that's what we're working. That's going to be a really fun book. Very different from The Religious Question in Modern China. Very ethnographic, a lot of thick description, a lot of funny stories. Imagine all these New Agers, angel channelers, peyote smokers, witches.
How could you lose, right, with that crew?
And see what happens when they meet with hermits, monks in a powerful mountain. We're writing that. I have the next project that I've started working on a little more than a year ago with the social science faculty of the University of Hong Kong, more of a what we call at Hong Kong U knowledge exchange. It's how do you bring the knowledge of the university how do you communicate or collaborate with the broader society, and in this case it's with the third sector. So I have a project called Spiritual Values in the Third Sector, and where we're working with some faith-based NGOs in Hong Kong and looking how they apply their spiritual, their religious and spiritual values and the type of social action that they conduct in the community. And what is it that, how are they different? Are they different? And what is it that gives them that extra capacity or extra empowerment or extra spiritual capital, as we're also looking at this concept in what they do in the community and in society. So we're looking at primarily some Christian and Buddhist groups, and we're trying to devise models from their experiences, which will then be used in training of NGO leaders. So that's in a sense a more practical or applied project. I'm still don't know exactly where it's leading, but it's been very interesting so far. And I also have a project which is more in classical ethnography and anthropology of a ritual tradition in northern Guangdong province, which combines Lushan Taoist and Xianghua Buddhist ritual traditions. And it's going back to the ethnography of traditional religion in Chinese villages. And I guess what I hope to do with that is really engage with some of the newer developments in anthropological theory and see how we can really bring the Chinese material on Chinese, the ethnography of Chinese religion, really bring that into the theoretical discussions in anthropology.
Great. Well, we look forward to seeing more of those. And thanks again for joining us and giving us some of your time.
Yeah, thank you very much, Christian.
You've been listening to New Books in Religion. That was my conversation with Vincent Gousser and David Palmer about The Religious Question in Modern China, published with University of Chicago Press in 2011. Thanks again for listening.